Happy Monday, everybody.
Happy Monday. It's good to be here, Joe.
Yeah, it's good to be here, too.
Oh, sorry, the suspense was killing everybody.
Like, yeah, what? Yeah. Welcome, Cedric and Sam. Yeah, thanks for joining us on the show today.
How y'all doing?
Good. What time is it over your end?
9 a.m.
Ooh, okay. It's 11 p.m. on my end. Yeah.
Well, but no, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for staying up.
Yeah, I mean, we should be thanking you, really. Anyway, yeah, it's good to see you guys. I mean, Cedric, been a longtime reader of your of Common Cog, your blog. I think it's one of the smartest pieces of writing on the internet. So it's good to finally have you on the show. So
thank you. Wow. Did not we were just saying before the recording started that I did not expect to be on the show because I don't typically write about data. But recently, our interests have converged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Finally.
Yeah.
I guess one of our major concerns broadly is that in our industry, so in the tech industry, there's a lot of focus on data for the sake of data. And you're very focused on data for use cases for business. And so we would like to see a lot more of that because that justifies the big budgets that this kind of work demands. I mean, that's the reality.
Yeah, exactly. Let me back up, though. For people who don't know who you two are, do you want to give a quick intro, maybe starting with Sam?
So I currently work in tech, but used to come from manufacturing. And that brings me sort of here because I was interested in statistical process control. And I was a sort of a longtime friend of Cedric's. And when he started writing on the topic, I was sort of able to tell him, these are the first things you're ever taught when you go into a factory. This is the first thing you're ever taught when you do quality engineering. And so we're able to like battle test their ideas and what it led to Xamarin, which we'll hopefully talk about today.
Yeah, and on my end, I write a blog, and it's mostly about business. I whatchamacallit, consider myself a business writer, I guess is how to put it, and a business owner. And my experience, my background is, primarily I graduated in software, and then I ran a company for a Singapore, like the Vietnam office for a Singapore company for number of years, and sort of my entire shtick is like, how do I get better at business, right? How do I get better at running businesses? So it was like engineering in the beginning and then marketing. And then at some point in the last 1.5 years ago, I did a project. I was very curious to sort of see like, how do I, you know, become data-driven as an operator, as a business operator? Maybe not a lot of business people think that, but I was curious and I not seen good examples. Pretty much every business that I'd run, even to millions of dollars from nothing, had zero data use, really. We just ran it by vibes, right? Like just by feel. And yep. I was very curious to sort of see like how. And so what happened was I wrote a summary of this book that written by former Amazon execs, Colin Breyer and Bill Carr. It was called Working Backwards. And it sort of detailed like, oh, here are the mechanisms. This is what makes Amazon, Amazon. And I wrote a summary about that. And Colin reached out and said, hey, you seem to get the book. You seem to be technical. We are interested in explicating the weekly business review, which is chapter 6 in the book, for our clients, our consulting clients. And it turns out that the WBR, as described in the book, is not enough to actually put the WBR to practice. And of course, me hearing this was like, you know, sign me up. Like, where do I sign up? Like, I'm going to help you write and I get to ask you questions every week on like, how did Amazon actually become data-driven? Like, because he was, Colin Breyer was there when they created the WBR process, right? So I did that. And at the very end of that project, which was around 6 months, right? He was like, oh, you should go read Donald Wheeler, Understanding Variation. And he kept, you know, saying throwaway words during the time that I was working with him, which is like things like, if you care about enough about this function, subject it to process control, throw it into the WBR, right? And I, you know, started asking like, what is process control? and long story short, that led to like a 1.5-year journey to trace the origins of these ideas to put them to practice. And wow. At the very end of it, I wrote a blog post that I then sent to Joe called Becoming Data Driven from First Principles that basically connects the origins of this, which was like 1930s. We'll talk about it in a bit, manufacturing. And then it seems to somehow, you know, through a long series of events, end up in Amazon. And then And then I was like, oh, you know, these ideas, because they're so old and so simple, finally I can use them to sort of explain to anybody, here is how you can become data-driven, right? Because there's no complex math. It's just a very simple set of ideas, a very simple set of worldviews. And then once you have them, then you can become data-driven. So I sent it to Joe, and Joe was like, okay, you can, you know, come on and let's talk about it.
Well, before we actually kicked off the stream, you were talking about how these ideas are actually really simple, but like very, very badly needed, even by companies that have been manufacturing things for 100 years. Maybe you could talk about that. Like, why are they simple? Why are businesses struggling with these basic processes, and why do they need help?
That's a really good question. Sam, just to check, right? Sam comes from manufacturing, right? So are these ideas still used broadly in manufacturing today?
Yeah, so it's the first thing, whenever you enter like a factory, at least the first time, it's one of the first things you're taught, like the Magnificent Seven, sort of like control charts, Pareto charts. You go through all that sort of training. And if you do any form of quality, you usually go through like the Six Sigma from the US, which is basically a derivation of statistical quality control. And I think the simplicity is really generated by like your workforce inside a factory. You can't always guarantee as a high level of education. They were built prior to computers, so you had to calculate either manually or via like heuristics, like on graph paper. So they were just designed by necessity to be very simple to build, very simple to understand. And they often just have a sort of like just follow the rules element to them. The robustness is just sort of built in inherently. The interesting part for me in this, where like me and Cedric, at least in the initial part, had differences, which I've sort of come around to his perspective, was they're not used really outside of the factory floor. I had never seen a sort of like a sales chart put on it. I'd never seen invoices or anything. But when you go for training, they often try and show examples, which are sort of like a hospital waiting room, because they often say hospitals are the classic place you can do it because they're quite similar to a factory. And I think the thing, like the idea that I've really sort of taken on, is that it can be applied more broadly. And there are like a bunch of questions inside a business when you're trying to build that causal model of like, you can't run A/B tests, but you can run more simple analyses using control charts and other tools, and which are the best you can get to getting sort of real knowledge about how your business works.
To answer your question more directly, Matt, if you think about it, right, like what is the why businesses need this kind of help? It goes all the way back to like an observation that one of the originators of this body of work, right, W. Edwards Deming, had about data use in the real world, right? Which is that in the real world, your charts don't look nice, you know, beautiful, simple line graphs. They don't. They wiggle all the time, right? And that wiggling is essentially noise, and that wiggling gets in the way of you as a business person sort of looking at the chart and sort of concluding, hey, is this getting better or is this getting worse, right? It seems very stupid and obvious to say, but we know this. We know this from weighing ourselves on a weighing scale, right? If I come to you and I tell you that, hey, routine variation is a thing. Variation is a thing in everything that you measure. You won't be surprised, because we all have the experience of like, oh, we weigh ourselves, and then like today we're you know, heavier than we were yesterday, and then we were like, oh, maybe, you know, we have water retention. Maybe tomorrow it will be lighter, and indeed, maybe tomorrow you are lighter, right? And this wiggling makes it very difficult for you to say, ah, today is the day that I have become fat. Over a long period.
The trailing averages, right?
Yeah. So if you have this problem, right, this problem baked into any kind of use of data, right, then you cannot do what humans are very good at. And what are humans very good at? Humans are very good at doing trial and error. We learn to walk using trial and error. We learn, like, if you climb a tree and you fall off the tree, right, you will learn, huh, let's not do that again, right? But if you have your feedback mechanism in the business is this spiky, wiggly sort of thing, right, you're not able to do trial and error easily. And so therefore, you cannot learn what's good or bad. You can't learn that, hey, that marketing campaign was good or bad. You can't learn that, hey, training salespeople this way is good or bad. Or at least you can't learn it quickly. Usually over a period of months, you'll be like, the feeling, it feels bad. Like, I think there's something wrong. We need to go fix it. But then you've just wasted like an extra 2 or 3 months when it's not necessary, right? So Deming's sort of core sort of observation is, look, humans are very good at trial and error. Number two, it's very difficult to do trial and error when you have noisy feedback. We need a way that is easy enough to chart out by hand that any factory worker can sort of just look at and go like, okay, there's a signal here. Like things are going up or going down, right? Or something is going has gone wrong, we need to investigate. And that's it. That's the core insight of statistical process control, right? And then you can go to these not very highly educated factory workers. Remember, this was like invented in the 1930s. It was put into mass production in use in the war effort, right? Deming was sort of pushed by the ordnance department to go down and train factory managers to like use this for creating war material for World War II, right? So basically, it's just the you know the message was very simple. Here's a chart that tells you if there's signal in the noise, in the wiggling. Your job is to figure out things that cause the chart to go bad. Like maybe if, you know, in manufacturing, it's usually like you don't want the variation to be too wide. Or like maybe you see sort of see in your numbers like, oh, this is a spike downwards. That's bad. Go and investigate those points. Ignore everything else. Just investigate those points. Remove those bad things from your process. And if you see good things, go figure out creative ways to improve your process so you see more of the positive things. And that's it. That is it. Right. And so that's the core of the insight in manufacturing, where sort of the writing, my recent writing has come in, and sort of like where Sam and I had to come together before, like, you know, he said he had to come around, was the idea that you can apply this to any process in your business, not just manufacturing. That was, I think, the leap that Amazon made back in the early 2000s when they hired a whole bunch of manufacturing people who came in and reorganized their warehouses as factories. Somebody in the S team or a number of people in the S team then looked at these ideas and go like, you know, can we apply this to the rest of the company? And they did, and it worked.
Well, it introduces something I think that's very foreign to, quote, business people. And that's the idea that there's upper and lower bounds, i.e. a range. Mm-hmm. I think in business school, you're taught to think about what's the number that I need to hit, right?
Yeah.
You're always singularly focused on a very deterministic outcome where it's, I don't care about the range. Just tell me what my number is. I can't tell you how many times I heard this when I do forecasting, for example, right? Like, I don't need the range. I just need the number. And I'm like, this is the exact opposite way you should think about this problem, actually, because the world doesn't exist as a point in time. It exists as a range of possible outcomes. I think it is interesting because the notion of statistical process control in the context of business outcomes, it's on one hand, it makes total sense and it seems like the most basic thing. But I think if you were to talk to non-nerds, it would cause somewhat of a visceral reaction. I like I said, I've seen this before where people are like, you know, don't trouble me with these stupid charts. Just give me the number I need to hit, and I'll just go hit it. But then it becomes sort of I know you had an article on Goodhart's Law as well, where maybe talk about that too. But it's interesting where you start getting these interesting feedback loops, I suppose, in business. I don't know. What have you seen, Matt? Have you seen we always talk about this, actually. I think you always talk about probable outcomes versus deterministic outcomes when we're out walking, for example, because we're very exciting people.
You just talked about it. The fact that you just talked about this, Cedric, the fact that humans are, we're good at trial and error. We're bad at assuming randomness in general, right? We have a really hard time embracing the idea that I'm the CEO. I should be able to just declare what's going to happen and get people to do it. And I shouldn't have to worry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I shouldn't have to worry about the randomness in the system and then just take that into account in my numbers and say, it's okay that we didn't hit the numbers this time because that was a random outcome. Hey, good job. Because overall, we see in the charts in this data that we're actually improving over the long term. That generally, that's not how it works when the CFO, CEO looks at the numbers. And in fact, one specific example, I'm curious if either of you have read the book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism. Joe and I have both read this book.
Oh, you would love this one.
Wow. What's it about?
It's about Jack Welch and General Electric. And just to give some context to this, so my dad worked for GE in the 90s, and he did not like Jack Welch, let's just say. Anyway, one of the problems, I think it's good to set goals, right? We probably all agree with that in business. But the thing that maybe should have raised suspicion earlier is that GE would always hit its numbers on the dot, not over, not under. And then it turned out with further investigation as we got into the 2000s, there was a lot of what you would call accounting fraud going on to make that happen, right? Yep. And if the numbers look too good, my cousin said this. He used to run a coffee shop, and he said, if my drawer comes in on the dot every night, that probably means someone is stealing from me, because things happen when you're collecting cash at a coffee shop. You're going to come in under or over. And same kind of thing. When a business hits the number exactly, or a manufacturer hits the number exactly every time, and there's no randomness, you should
start GE was doing some crazy stuff in that book. They're talking about how they would move shipments of inventory and count that as a sale.
Wow. Brilliant.
They would do things like they would, if I ran one division and I had some kind of a business relationship with another division of the company, I would call up my counterpart and say, hey, can you order more of this so I can hit my number? And then, you know, I'll try to scratch your back in the future. Like, not real business.
It's a classic thing in manufacturing. So, like, an even more common one, which even everyone does but isn't illegal, which is you have to shut everything, all your orders, you pull them back to the last week of the month. And it just smashes everything, because you can imagine the variation you've introduced into the system of pulling 3/4 of your volume into one. And in fact, the whole point of into lean or anything like that, the whole point is the level gets some, as reduced the variation you've put into the system as much as possible.
Well, yeah, and this introduces, you know, not to get off topic, but here we are. in manufacturing, there's a thing called the bullwhip effect.
Right? Yes.
So small variations in your upstream forecast, maybe at the retail level, that reverberates down massively at the raw component level, to the point where it screws everything up. So when you start channel stuffing or pulling sales forward, as you say, this also has the same effect, or it causes artificial demand. And really, you're just robbing Peter to pay Paul, as the old saying goes, right? Nothing intrinsically changed. There was no demand. You just wanted to hit your number.
Which is interesting. So, like, when Cedric started sharing these books with me, the part that surprised me as much as anything was the title, like understanding variation. You talked about this idea that CEOs and business people really dislike this concept of like a band. And I think the advantage of like the XMR charts, like, they just visualize it so clearly and so simply. And I think that's like one of the reasons that we got drawn to it.
Yeah. So one of the, at this point, multiple people have started trying to experiment with XMR charts, and some of them are data consultants. And one of the happiest things that I have heard recently is like multiple data consultants going like, I had a client who used to ask why sales was down last week by 12% or sales is up this week. They no longer ask this question, because I just show them on the chart, and the chart has two lines, and I say that we don't talk about the numbers when there's between the two lines. We talk about it when one of the rules are triggered. That's otherwise cool. It's perfectly normal, right? It's like, and I had another sort of person talk to me, and this was somebody on a Google's revenue forecasting team, and according to him, like, the revenue forecasting team was filled with incredible analysts, right? They can forecast Google's revenue down to a 0.5% error rate, right?
Dang.
And they never taught, he at least never taught when he was on a team, like, to apply his ideas, like this knowledge about variation, to the salespeople. When they sat down with the salespeople, the quarterly review, they'll be like, why are we down 11%? At no point did he stop to think, wait a minute, is this routine variation? Because like, it's not just people. You can't yell at people. People are part of a system, a complex system, and also part of a broader market, right? And there is such a thing as routine variation, even for individual performance. So like, just putting things on a chart with two lines, as stupid as that sounds, right? As dumb as it is, and obvious to sort of say like, oh, you know, when you see a chart that goes up and down according to a trend, a forecast, right, you need to expect 50% of the time to be above and below, right? That's what people always say. But for some reason, business people can't deal with that. But then when you draw two lines, you say the rule is we don't talk about it if it's between the two lines, unless there's a signal that's triggered. Then they're like, okay, cool.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, let's talk from like the investor perspective and the CEO and the CFO perspective. Is this a sufficient method to kind of train people to embrace randomness? Is it possible to get this message out there to investors to say, hey, when the quarterly numbers come in, we expect this much variation. And so if you're a little bit below, don't get too excited. And if you're a little bit above, it's not that the company is necessarily killing it right away.
When you say randomness, so are you talking about, in math speak, it would be the epsilon, i.e. the uncontrolled random versus like basically parameterized randomness where you have somewhat control over that? Like what type of randomness are you talking about?
I guess I'm talking about routine variation. I mean, that's kind of a cross between a math term and a business term, but I think it's very apt. I mean,
Yes. So there are many, because it's such an old field, right? So there are many terms for the various concepts. I'm going to stick to Donald Wheeler's terminology because sometime in the late 80s, he realized that trying to use these manufacturing or statistics terms was causing more confusion than not. And then he has this entire appendix at the end of Understanding Variation going like, okay, we're not going to use a common cause of variation. We're just going to say... Okay. Routine variation, exceptional variation, and then we're going to define certain things like if a process only shows routine variation, it is a predictable process because we know that it's going to be between two lines. We don't know where exactly, but we know that between two lines. And if it shows exceptional variation in addition to routine variation, we're going to call it an unpredictable process. And so I introduce these terms because for the rest of the podcast, I'm going to use these terms, right? To sort of answer your question more directly, I think it's not possible if you're talking about investor relations, right? But the way that Amazon did it was very instructive, right? So this is public information. So I'm not sort of telling stories that Colin told me privately. But so two stories.
Oh, spill the beans, man. Come on.
I need to get permission first. There's some interesting stories that I do want to. So working backwards, there is a story where Jeff Bezos and Colin Breyer go and meet a CEO. And then during the meeting, somebody, you know, a secretary of the CEO comes in and brings in like a piece of paper with like the stock movement for that day. And they were like, oh, yes, the stock is up by like 3%. Very good. And then on the drive back, Bezos says to Breyer, you know, that's irrelevant because like whatever stock performance, like at whatever price is reflected in the stock, it reflects something that the CEO did, the whole company did maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago, right? And similarly, what we're doing is like going to affect our stock price like 3 years in the future, right? So we shouldn't like think about it as like a reflection of our intelligence. And this is also partly like Amazon's history because it went through, you know, the dot-com bust and the stock was underperforming for like 8 years, I think, after the dot-com bust. That story, I think, is illustrative of the way Amazon thought about it, right? Because they run a weekly business review every Wednesday morning. So every Sunday night, all the metrics are generated for the WBR. Monday morning, the metrics owners across the company come in and take a look at it. They identify exceptional variation. If there's exceptional variation, they go and investigate. The departmental WBR happens on Tuesday morning. They discuss only the exceptional variation. By Wednesday, you better have a good answer for like why is there exceptional variation, because the entire meeting is 400 to 500 metrics, but it's exception driven, which means that we only talk about exceptional variation. There's no exceptional variation, we say nothing to see here, move next. And then everybody looks at the metric for 1 second so that they have a feel for like what looks normal for that metric, and then they move on to the next metric, right? And then you'll be asked, okay, it's exceptional variation. What happened? Was it a hurricane? Mm-hmm. Was it there was a labor strike? Maybe like the post office was closed, or like you know there was some problem with that particular region's post office delivery. And they knew, right, to down to very small granular details, like what was affecting the business on a day to day, month to month level, right? And there is this blog post by an early Amazon analyst called Eugene Wei. The title of the blog post is "Remove the Legend to Become One." And he talked about
that wins.
He's a good writer.
Very good blog post. I highly recommend it. And he talks about putting together the precursor to the weekly business review and how, because they knew the numbers so well, they could predict to like the maybe like one or two percentage error, what their revenue would be for that year, for that quarter, right? And then it became a matter of like, setting a slightly conservative revenue target and then overhitting it, like, and then acting surprised, like, oh, we didn't expect, but actually they knew to like a error rate of like a couple percentage points, like what exactly was the revenue. But apparently this is a game that everybody has learned to play, right, in IR. So this is not a so those are the two stories. One is in Working Backwards and one is Eugene Wei's explanation of the early history of the WBR, because many of those ideas actually still turn up in the WBR, which is still being done today, every Wednesday morning.
That's interesting. You, kind of rewinding a bit, you mentioned something measuring predictability, I think you called it, or something like that. Walk us through that. Like, why is that important? And I guess under what conditions are you able to do this?
Measuring so a process is this is a deep question. A process is predictable when you only see routine variation, right? Which means that you know within a certain band, right? Your time series will be between a certain band. And there are more advanced ways of doing process behavior charts, which I don't talk about publicly yet, because people are sort of still wrapping their heads around this, right? Where you can sort of slant it. Sam is very experienced with this. He was talking to me about, he was actually doing some of the more calculated complex math for when we were putting together Xamarin, which is this tool that we're going to talk about, this tool that we built. But essentially, right, when you look at a metric, any metric in the real world, there will be some kind of randomness from lots of tiny little factors that you don't actually care about and you can't really control, right? And these factors can be characterized as randomness drawn from some probability distribution, right? And that's the thing that causes us difficulty, human beings difficulty, right? So it could be any kind of distribution. We don't really care because most of us in the real world, we're not sophisticated. Most people in business are not sophisticated enough to sort of think about probability distribution. But you can sort of imagine, like, hey, you know, like, there's this some kind of, if it's in a steady state, right, there's going to be a randomness drawn from some probability, one probability distribution. Now, what the XMR chart actually does is that it detects, it is a homogeneity test. It is a test for the presence of probability distributions, more than one probability distribution. So if something else happens, something bad or new happens, right, you should see variation that is above and beyond what can be explained if there's only one probability distribution explaining the randomness. Alternatively, if you have successfully changed your process, right, you've done some change, you've changed your training, you have bought new technology, then the process behavior, the randomness after that change will be different from before the change. And so now the XMR chart will be able to tell you, hey, you're looking at more than one probability distribution here, right, which means your change has worked. Sort of going back to what Sam said about like why these things have been stuck in manufacturing, this is actually something that went on between him and me when we were sort of debating this earlier, right? He was sort of saying, how can you use this outside of manufacturing, right? And I was like, hey, there's this guy called Donald Wheeler, who's a statistician, and he has a whole book sort of saying that you can, right? And then eventually, it took many months, but what we figured out was that in manufacturing, what they use these charts for is to reduce variation. Because in manufacturing, you want parts to be like very similar, because quality is a function of variation. If you reduce variation at every step of the production process, you don't need to do QA at the end, you're going to get like a 99.99% like quality rate, right? And so therefore, everybody who looks at these charts, they think automatically that these control charts are charts to reduce variation. They don't realize that actually what these charts are, what they were originally, like the math, the stats on which they were built on, is that they are tools to characterize variation, which means outside of manufacturing, you can use it to detect when you have a change in variation, which means now you have a reliable tool to apply to any process to say that, hey, has things changed? Has this changed? And that opens up a lot of things. It opens up, like, you can start doing improvements to your sales process, your marketing process, to whatever, right? And immediately tell with confidence, like, after a certain number of data points, like, okay, there's a change here. It has worked. Or you can also use it to sort of say, investigate this point, don't investigate that point, which is, you know, a lifesaver. Because I'm sure all of us will know that we'd be sent on wild goose chases because sales or marketing goes like, you know, look at this, like, we're down 20%. Like, you know, how do you know if it's abnormal? Maybe it's completely routine variation. And yet you are asked to go and do a kabuki dance to like sort of investigate and explain away that this 20% variance. Okay, I think I've talked long enough. Is that a good enough answer, Joe?
Yeah, it is.
It's a great answer. Let me ask, I want to ask a follow-up question to Sam. So you basically said that in manufacturing, this is the culture. These are the tools you use. This is how we assess variation. This is how we reduce it over time. And I think both of you agree that there is an opportunity to use the same techniques outside of manufacturing. How do we socialize this? How do we change the culture outside the manufacturing world to actually get these tools into use?
So our theory at the moment is there are a bunch of people who benefit from this. and that there's just an awareness issue. And the idea behind us making Xamarin is to make them more aware. But we think there is also just a fiddliness issue. If you don't know if you've ever tried to make the charts in Excel, it is a bit of a mess and it's pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. So when we set out, we were sort of saying, okay, there are these bunch of people that bluntly are a bit like me that are not statistically inclined, that need a simple yes-no gauge to know when they should act and when they should not. And they need it to be as simple as possible. So I think the socialization is as much by reducing the friction and then by increasing the awareness. And I think like one of the goals that we have sort of long-term is a lot more of these BI tools that people use, like Looker, like Power BI, should start to think about including these things as sort of a standard. And it's like long-term, as Cedric said before the podcast, this idea of having a wall of shame inside the Xamarin site of like, hey, you could add this as a standard thing against your line chart. You already produced the line chart. It'd be very easy for you to add on the XMR chart as an extra step. But I think, yeah, I think there is also a cultural gap. So one thing I've noticed in manufacturing is so when I started, there was a lot of writing on manufacturing. A lot of great writers in the 80s, 70s were from manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, when was the last time you read a blog post from a manufacturer that wasn't a puff piece? Whereas I'm now in tech, and you've got podcasts right now. There are great blog posts from people that run the industry. Where I got manufacturing, there are a few, but effectively, it's because it's lost cultural relevance, it has become less. And like, it was one of the great things, maybe prime with Cedric, is like, okay, there is now a culture of blogs, there's a culture of YouTubers we're on now, where we can actually spread these ideas.
Yeah.
Don't think it's gonna happen overnight, but at least long-term, we think there are a bunch of people would benefit about us like, making it more easy for them to use.
I think that's spot on too. I mean, it's interesting. Supply chain came back in vogue for a split second during COVID when supply chains stopped working as normal. No pun intended. Then everyone was like, oh yeah, gosh, like we do get our things from other places. And when those things don't work, it's amazing what happens. But it took like an absolute catastrophe for that to, I think, resonate with people. And then we're back to normal again, right? I mean, whatever that is. I think, because it's one of those invisible things, I guess, right? In software, I guess, it's the same as DevOps. Like, why would you care about ops and making sure that you can control incidents and respond to them? It's just like a bit.
If I may rant a bit about this, like, so as a business person who wanted to get good at data, right? So I read all the prerequisite books. I read Lean Analytics, which, you know, it's a terrible book. I read a whole bunch of blog posts from the data community, like maybe nearly every blog out there. I read a whole bunch of vendor blogs. I wanted to become data-driven. But I think one of the problems of the tech industry is that, especially if you compare it to the manufacturing industry, is that there is a fixation on tools that the tech industry has. Oh, yeah. I say this as somebody from the tech industry, right? We fixate on, there are a gajillion blog posts on how to build a data warehouse, on how to use DBT, on how to, like, the rise of the analytics engineer. That's another thing that, you know, well, manufacturing has fads as well. So, yeah. But one thing that I did not find is I wanted a blog post to explain to me, who cares about the tools? Just give me the basic worldviews and ideas necessary for me to make sense of the tools. Sure, I can learn the technical skills necessary to learn the tools. I'm a programmer by training. I can read technical documentation all day, right? I did this, like, COVID was very long. I finished Kimball's data modeling textbook. It's horribly written, by the way. Wonderfully written, badly organized, but he did. I then regret, you know, I found out that you should read the third edition because that's when he gives you an index of the ideas.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Because for those of you who are listening, who have never read the book, it's organized by industry. So it's like insurance and then manufacturing and then
the techniques sort of flow.
Yes, they do. They do flow. But then if you want a quick, like, sort of like, I just want to know what the basic meaty ideas are. My suspicion is that, like, in the decade after he published the book, because it was a landmark book, other people then wrote easier to approach idea by idea, sort of like introductions to data modeling. Yeah. Joe, I'm sure your book will not be industry by industry.
I'm not doing it that way.
Yeah. Nobody
would. I saw what he did and I was like, it's cool. Not going
to
take that.
Well,
approach.
To be fair, he was inventing the whole practice, right? Yeah. So, you know.
No, it's a, I mean, it's a great book, but you're absolutely right, though. And I think that there's, but what I find interesting in the whole discussion in data, and when you bring up the Looker example, I was thinking about it, is we, again, I think it's kind of back to how data science is taught, or data is taught these days, too, where it's tools and I would say very superficial view of techniques, but not driving towards the outcome, right? So an XMR chart, for example, it inherently drives towards some sort of an outcome.
Yes.
Right? Reducing variation being one of the key ones, being able to predict what's going to happen in your business. I mean, you would think that these would be kind of table stakes things you'd want in your business. I can't see a scenario where I'm like, I want to have my business as unpredictable as possible with wild variation in every process imaginable. Like, this is really how I want to run my business. Do you want to run a business like that?
No, not a good idea. So. Okay. Yeah.
But this is how people are taught. So I think to your point, when I saw your article on the data driven series, I was like, okay, this is awesome. But somebody's thinking about this, and I think in a very different and honest way. Because I think you're absolutely right. The data industry, I think it's so fixated on data stuff that it loses a bigger picture. I mean, I was talking about this the other day, ranting on a LinkedIn, just how we talk about value all the time. And no offense to Matt, he's writing a book on it, but it was like, we talk about it, but we have a hard time, I think, understanding how it's actually delivered. And I point out there's an inverse correlation between how much you talk about delivering value and how much you actually deliver it.
Oh, completely agree. And I think part of the problem too is that we try to attach a price tag to everything now. And Cedric, I saw some of your writing on Deming. And the interesting thing about Deming is that there's not a lot about the financials there. It's more like vision and product and like these other core ideas, tying those to statistics and tying those to data. Ooh. It turns out that's, if you want to build a great company, you need things like great products.
Well, and customers that like those products.
Customers that like those products that are loyal. Yeah.
Wait, that's all.
So I ranted a bit techniques, right? Lack of techniques. And this is like sort of my segue to sort of talk about Deming a bit. Deming did talk about costs, but I think the more important thing for him was that he introduced if you think about it, there are two major techniques two major sort of approaches to using data to drive business outcomes in the data-driven series that I really wanted to find out there in the sort of body of work that the data community has produced and that I didn't find, right? The first one is this is my nomenclature. This is my terminology, right? But I sort of talk about the optimization worldview versus the process control worldview. And I only use the word process control because that's what Colin was using. And I'm sure inside Amazon, Jeff Wilkie was the COO for many years. And he introduced many of these ideas. On down, they use the word process control. But I just want to describe this a bit because I think people listening to this might find this useful. So most people, when you tell them, hey, here is data, right? Like, here's data, and you're going to use data in some business contexts. They will immediately, through no fault of their own, default to an optimization worldview. Oh, yeah. Okay, so this is a number. How do I make it go up? Or there's a conversion step in between some funnel. How do I make it go up, right? The process control worldview, the worldview that XMR charts and manufacturing give you, is a very different kind of worldview. Mm-hmm. And this was a thing that was very difficult to put my finger on when I was working with Colin and asking him questions and listening to him week on week, right? The process control worldview is this. Everything in your business is a process. Any process will throw off some stream of data. Now, the data might not be a perfect proxy for the thing that you're trying to measure, but that's your job. Your job as a business operator is to exercise judgment to find better proxies for the things that you want to measure. Okay. Your job, when you see the stream of data, is to figure out what are the root causes, the control factors that will increase or decrease that number, the process number, right? Maybe it's better if it's higher or lower. You just try to figure out what the root causes are. Right. And then if you had, I will give you a tool, a data tool to do this. Actually, there are a number of data tools, but the simplest one is just the XMR chart. Right. using the XMR chart, the XMR chart will tell you when to investigate when numbers are weird. And through this investigation, you will find root causes that can then affect the process. Maybe it's a positive thing, in which case you should ask yourself, how can we change the process to incorporate more of this amazing thing that has just happened by accident? Maybe it's a negative thing, in which case you ask, how can we redesign the process so that we avoid this negative thing that's affecting our numbers? We don't want it to go down, right? That's a very different worldview. And as I explained in the blog post, right, having this worldview, what it does is that if you apply this rigorously across the entire company, across everything you care about, right? What will happen is that eventually, like across your entire company, you will start figuring out the actual causal model of your business. Yep. The WBR is not 400 to 500 metrics because they want 400 to 500 metrics. They will be very happy if it's just like 100 metrics or just 5 metrics. Mm-hmm. It is 400 to 500 metrics because they keep running process control and they keep discovering new control factors. And then eventually, Colin did tell me this. This was like one of the number one questions that Jeff would ask is that if this blow, when a blow up happens, right, what could we have been measuring so that we could have seen this coming? And then once somebody answers, say, okay, that's in a WBR from now on, right? Or okay, we're not on track to hit target for this particular goal. We haven't figured out the right controllable input metrics. That's their term for control factors. Let's change the controllable input metrics we're tracking now, throw it away, and come up with new ones next week, right? And then we drive it and see how long it'll take to change the output metric we care about. This is a fundamentally different worldview from the optimization worldview. This is a scientific, let's go figure out the root causes. Let's do that for everything. And it's fractal, right? You figure something out, like you then drive it down. And for a brief period, even the hiring process was part of the WBR because there was upstream of a lot of leaders in Amazon not being able to hit their targets, right? So they subjected hiring to process control. And what happened? Of course, hiring, like when you as the hiring manager have to present your numbers in front of the entire leadership team every Wednesday morning, what happens is you become very motivated to figure out root causes and try to improve process control, right? So anyway, this is like the big idea. I have one other sort of big idea that I found from this body of work, but maybe I'll just stop there. We have a bunch of questions as well.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions I want to get to. The audience has asked, Jenna, first question for you two. How would you apply these methods to organizations not driven by profit, e.g. a government? And what types of practitioners that exist in most organizations are best suited to apply these methods? And how do they best upskill to do so? That's a good question.
So, I mean, the classic place that often talks about this is healthcare. I think the reason healthcare gets talked about is because it has a lot of similarity to factories where you can, so classically the ER, like ER, NHS in the UK, very big SPC users. They must be the biggest organization in the world, I would imagine, that uses them. And one thing when I was listening to Cedric just talk there is the advantage a factory has is you work every day to reduce the amount of noise in your process. You get the air conditioning set. You set all the machines at the right temperature. You repair the machines on a regular basis to the point where you can really narrow down to the causes that actually affect your system. And like, you do know it must be one or two things or three things, whereas the real world has a lot more going on. So I guess if in my sense, I'd be picking things which have less variation at the beginning to start with, or less inputs. Classically, like you could think about like queue areas, things like that, or even like back-end office stuff. So like invoicing, things where you have errors. These are the traditional things, because going for the hardest thing first is going to cause some pain. And in terms of upskilling, for the simplest stuff, the online sort of education is still pretty good. But you can always go down the more traditional of like you can go get a SBC Six Sigma qualification. But I think most of the time you can just read what's available, and hopefully we've made the Xamarin as simple as possible, such that you can learn, and there'll be some emails as well you can sign up for.
Yeah. Well, the emails aren't hooked up yet, but eventually if you sign up now.
Yeah. It sort of ties into Auntie's question too, which were the best books about XMR charts. I think you mentioned understanding variation.
Yes, understanding variation is the simplest. It is 150 pages. You will finish it in an afternoon. Making sense of data is where you want to get it if you want to use these methods outside of manufacturing. Measures of success is So if we do our work right, Xamarin.com will eventually have enough articles such that you don't need to read Measures of Success. Measures of Success is a much gentler introduction to these ideas. And the nice thing about Mark Graban's book is that he talks about how do you actually use this in practice that Wheeler sometimes doesn't. Wheeler has this weird writing style where it's halfway to academies, but then he doesn't actually have citations. So a lot of the stats I have to like so chase down the actual, because I wanted to know like what the actual, yeah. So Wheeler is incredibly, like it's an impeccable writer and very rigorous and making sense of data should be all you need if you want to start applying this. And I think if you just stick to those two and you use Xamarin and you start experimenting with it, you can go very far. You don't necessarily have to read Measures of Success. If you do want to read Measures of Success, I recommend reading the appendix first because that's where the actual sort of here's how you put this to practice step by step is. And I got a huge amount of value out of that. I just want to answer Jenna's point because this allows me to sort of bring up the... I said that there were two big ideas that I found from this body of work. So to answer your question, Jenna, if you've ever attempted to improve something in your company, doesn't matter what it is, it could be software development, it could be invoicing, it could be whatever, right? The core idea in continuous improvement is that you have to answer three questions. And the three questions are, what are you trying to accomplish with this improvement? How are you going to accomplish it? That's your hypothesis, right, of mechanism. And then at the very end, like, how do you know you have accomplished it? And if you think about these three questions, the vast majority of people, when they try to, a salesperson changing the sales training process, a marketing person proposing some kind of new campaign because what's currently happening isn't working, right? They will be able to tell you, number one, they may be able to tell you like a mechanism for like how they would change it with this thing that they're proposing. They will not give you a way to answer number three. And the reason Deming taught the XMR chart was so that everybody could answer question number three, which is how would you know that you've accomplished it? You just draw a divider on the XMR chart and wait minimum six to eight data points to sort of see, is there a real change in variation? Otherwise you've made no change. And therefore you need to go back to the drawing board and you need to update your intuition of like what might work when you're changing a thing. So, to answer your question, how do you upskill? Start today. Just use an XMR chart. And when the next time you know somebody suggests a manager or somebody suggests an improvement, see if you can answer all three questions and then give it a try and see what happens.
Speaking of XMR charts, we'll talk about Xamarin real quick. Since you guys are launching this, and I think it's actually really, really cool. What is this?
Sam, you want to talk about it?
So this is our attempt to make them easier. So we talked about the friction. They're like quite annoying to make. And before the call, we were talking about the way I learned to make them was through a program called Minitab, which is highly expensive, I think only used in manufacturing. And we just realized that there was no easy way to make them, so we made Xamarin. This is sort of the blog. This is the front page explaining why you'd want them. And I think the message that we've sent is like, are you worried when, or are you happy when you see your numbers wiggle up and down? Do you know what you have to do or not to do? XMR charts give you that ability. And on the screen right now is a picture of one of the Xamarin charts. And the idea being the tool draws the blue lines for you, which are all your process limits, and it draws the red center line, which is your process average. And for basically all intents and purposes, if your points are within the two blue lines, they're pretty good and not to worry. And there are a couple of other rules to check if your points are either trending very mildly off the center line or are like hovering just before the process limits. And if you click to the red tool,
click. Wait, hold this, on. On this tab. Yeah. Okay.
So this is going to be all open sourced. The code will be up there as of tomorrow, Cedric. You'll be able to tell me if
tomorrow
I'm
or Tuesday. Tomorrow or the day after, but probably tomorrow. It's actually ready.
And we said like, hey, we want to make it as simple as possible. You use Excel, we'll meet you where you're at. Copy and paste and dump it into the little spreadsheet on the left, and it will update. And bam, the entire goal is make this as low friction as possible. And if you add the dividers, Cedric was very big bullish on this. I'd never seen it before. This idea of like
dividers until it just looks.
Yeah.
You want to be able to segment the data because I think the idea of like you've made a change, have you made a difference? really get to the core of like those three questions that Cedric asked. The other way it's traditionally talked about is like the PDCA cycles, plan, do, check, act. Yeah. You got a plan, do the plan, check if you made a difference, and then act again and close the loop. And just making sure you're doing that continuous improvement style and then just keep checking over and over again. And if you start applying that to every part of your business, you can go a long, long way.
You end up with Amazon.
You can get advice, and that's what I guess in the long term, people have talked about like, oh, how does this interact with traditional data science? And we're sort of like, well, once you've got a really good foundation of like understanding your business, applying more formal methods is just going to be exponentially more powerful.
Right.
And this is just sort of the way to like push down, decentralize into the organization, the ability to run basic experiments as quickly as possible.
That's super cool. Hopefully people start using this approach.
Hopefully.
You mentioned the Excel hell of doing this too. I've done that before. It's super fun.
I had a question for you guys. So you work in a data consultancy. When you're trying to sell like more, I guess, more advanced versions of data, do you sort of run into these same problems again and again of like, what could you explain to me why the number's gone up or down this week? Is this normal? Is that sort of a question that you run into in your consultancy practice?
I think so. I mean, we tend to work more on the technology side, and I think there are limits to that approach, but we certainly try to work with the business side of the house to make sure that the tools we're helping to deploy will actually make a difference. Because if you build, we've seen this again and again, honestly, you build this like huge complex data warehouse with a perfect data model, and people are still just making a phone call and trying to get data from another person in the company and putting it in Excel and missing out on all those potential benefits.
But I think in a lot of those cases, that's more indicative of maybe an overall lack of cohesive processes in the business. Yeah. Right, I tend to view those architectural issues as more of a symptom of probably a broader issue, right? Because you spend a lot of, I mean, it isn't the tool at that point; it's the organization.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and then you start diving into like, why do you have these organizational, I wouldn't call them issues or whatever, but there tends to be, I think, be sort of just a universal lack of rigor, across the board. But that's not to say, I mean, I know that some of the big companies out there too that are, supposedly very rigorous also suffer from a lot of the same problems. So I do have a hard time putting my finger on exactly like how that, what's the root cause, Matt?
I want to go back to this. I think you said this, Sam, that the goal was to kind of push this down throughout the company so that experiments could be run anywhere. But like, I think in many cases, the opposite is needed. We sort of need to push it up or manage it up so that the CEO is seeing these charts and saying, oh, I shouldn't worry about the numbers being slightly off because this is just normal variation. And that still seems like a hard, hard social problem because businesses fundamentally are still hierarchical. And it's so true. It'd be very hard to convince up.
Well, it also comes back to the old Munger saying, though, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome, right? So it's the same. So you gotta, I think, couple that, this rigorous, observations and control against just the inherent motivations of executives, which is usually to make a boat ton of money for themselves. And so for lack of a better way of putting it, it's true.
So how do we convince them that this will make a boat ton of money?
Exactly. Okay,
you have to have a manufacturing crisis where the Japanese are coming and killing all your peers.
Well, did you point this out though, right? And that was one of the big drivers of this, right?
Yes,
why is it that American companies suddenly embraced lean when you had mass production going on for decades, I mean, even when the Fremont Toyota plant opened up, why was that initially full of disasters? Why couldn't you just like move lean directly into a manufacturing facility? Right. I mean, it was much more than just saying, here's some simple ways to do lean. In Fremont's case, it was, you just had a lot of baggage, cultural baggage that was happening. Right. So that's part of the other thing too, is I think a lot of these techniques are awesome, but I think that to Jenna's question, how do you apply, well, it's sort of paraphrasing, but it's how do you apply these, not just to nonprofits, but also just to companies that, weren't used to thinking this way, right? And so I think it's
Actually, Joe, you when the blog post came out, you left a comment in the Common Cog member forums asking sort of like how important are incentives to this, and it, like, you got straight at the most depressing part of this body of work, which is that it's hugely important. Deming refused to talk to middle management. He very famously threw out from his house a bunch of four middle managers. He said, you come back only when the CEO is here, or like only when you've got somebody in the C-suite. And the reason for that actually everything about Deming stems from his understanding of routine variation, right? Yeah. In continuous improvement, if you have a predictable process, which means it's just routine variation, the only way to improve it is you have to rethink the process. You have to buy new technology, you have to change the process, which might mean changing across departments, right? If it's exceptional variation, it's very clear what you need to do. You need to go investigate exceptional variation to make sure that it doesn't happen, or it happens more of it. If it's a good thing, then you want more of it to happen, right? But because changing a process, improving a process in routine variation that's predictable, requires fundamentally rethinking the process, the only people who in a company who can rethink a process is leadership. And so like Deming was like, you shouldn't blame workers if they're not able to perform to par, like to expectations. The people with the power are the ones who are, you know, the leaders. And if it's a routine variation, like system in routine variation, then it's on the leaders that performance sucks. And so therefore he was very hard and very harsh on leadership. It's like, you know, screw you. Your job is to give them the political cover so that they can improve and change the process. And one thing, if you go read, there's this wonderful book called The Birth of Lean. Sam turned me onto it. It's a history of how the people in Toyota invented the Toyota production system. You will see that it's actually management who gave them the cover to experiment. And not universally, there were pockets. Like Taiichi Ono had to experiment in like a tiny corner of the factory first. There are a lot of people said it couldn't be done. But essentially, you know, this method, this toolbox that I've just described that Deming sort of came up with, the whole chart thing, right? It's literally a toolbox that you can use to bootstrap your own Toyota production system from scratch, but leadership has to buy in. And that's
Toyota, I think, exemplifies this too early on when, after World War II, right? When Toyota was rebuilding its process and factory, it didn't have a lot of the resources that American companies had. I mean, they, I think they went to the Ford plant and they're like, yeah, we're not doing this because it's won't work. You know, and even I think they had some sort of a crisis where they had to lay off a bunch of workers. Yes. And the head of Toyota actually resigned and fell on his own sword because of that decision. Right? You would never see that in corporate America these days, or corporate anywhere. But like that exemplifies too, like the leadership also providing the cover, which they did after that, but also recognizing that it's ultimately their fault that this happened. You know, and then the cover part too is it's like, Toyota offered after that whole thing, they're like, anyone who's around, we're going to do lifelong employment as long as you work with us, right? And this also provided, I think, the incentive for continuous improvement, because you don't have to worry about, you know, if you're incentivized to continuously improve stuff because you have a job, right? So again, it's back to the incentive and outcomes versus today. If you're paranoid about losing your job every 5 seconds, what's there to continuously improve? I would be continuously improving my resume, probably. I could really care less about this company, right? So I think it's about, it's also about the, you know, the sort of environment that you're working in. Do I have the psychological safety to do the things that Toyota did? The add-on cord is a good example, right? Like stopping a whole production line. That's a cardinal sin in mass manufacturing. So
yeah,
just differences, right?
Talking So one thing that came up in the book I thought was very interesting that might enjoy, they only mildly reference statistical quality control. And the reason is like, we had the statistical quality control very early on inside the quality team, and that was our failure. The thing we had to do was to bring effectively quality and the ability to run these experiments and do process improvement throughout the entire organization. And they sort of make this point over and over again. It's like, it wasn't until then that we really could develop the system. And at least to me, that was like, oh yeah, it seems obvious, even in most manufacturers, they never get past statistical quality control. They never get past the quality team running all these things. And I actually wonder if there's this element of it within data science. The data team does all the analyses. They run the A/B tests.
Bingo.
They run the forecasts, and I receive a black box. And I think the black box idea is something we've really wanted to push against, because people have ownership and they should understand and have the autonomy to run their own things. But there's also responsibility that comes with that.
Yeah.
Like one of the big goals long term with it.
That's awesome. I mean, that to me is like one of the holy grails of like making quote data work and companies being quote data driven. Is again getting us out of this whole data. I mean, I think as I pointed out last week too, and as I keep ranting on and on, it's like I think quote data wins when you have to when you stop talking about data as a first class citizen.
Mm. Yep.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just yeah. Then it's just embedded in the business and all those practices are right versus you know, you have the data. I mean, it's exactly a siloing that I even you know, Jermack talks about in Data Mash, which is it's. You bring everything together to deliver a product at the end of the day. You guys should read her book on it's Data Mesh if you haven't read it. I think there's a lot of similarities between what you're talking about and manufacturing and the sort of the future state of what I think where I think data is going. I think she does too, but brilliant.
But presumably, Sam, to get these techniques out of the quality team, you have to simplify them basically. Like you can't be throwing these really complex statistical metrics at the guy on the assembly line or the gal on the assembly line expecting them to embrace that. You need to keep it very simple, basically.
Give them math, right?
I think it's proven, I now work at we work in companies that are far more advanced. Okay. And like, it doesn't matter. Like the finance team, people are very smart, get given these models of the forecast and they're like, okay. Good to know. I'll just take the number. They don't understand. And that's quite normal. And like, I think sometimes, I think people overestimate what most people can deal with. And I think they also underestimate the sheer number of problems or questions that they have at any one time that just can't be answered via traditional methods.
Yep.
We get dozens of questions a day. All of which you want to test at some level, and you need to be able to have the autonomy to do them yourself. I think, yeah, that's going to be critical. And it'd be interesting to know if there's actually that similarity between the way the quality team evolved inside manufacturing and the way the data science team evolved. You still need them at some level. Like, you're never going to get rid of your quality team. You're never going to get rid of your data science team. But there's definitely this idea that if they remain siloed, there is such a limitation to what you can achieve, and the best companies somehow manage to spread that across the organization in special ways.
I mean, you saw this with QA in software, right? So QA versus DevOps, right? And if you could, I mean, DevOps took basically just reappropriated lean for software. That's what happened. I mean, almost to a T, right? You had like Phoenix Project, which was basically you read that and the goal. You're like, oh, this is basically the same book. It's just moved. So.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think the goal, no pun intended, of DevOps was to democratize those practices to software. I mean, DevOps wasn't supposed to be a function. It was supposed to be a practice that every software engineer would just do. Obviously, that also didn't work and people have DevOps teams now.
I have mixed feelings about DevOps. I have mixed feelings about trying to take lean and applying it to software. I feel like the really applicable bit is this bit here, right? That Deming taught, right? Which is like, you have three questions. You're not supposed to copy lean and move it to some other domain. You're supposed to take the toolbox of asking the three questions, using control charts to sort of figure out if you've actually budged the metrics you care about, and then using that to figure out causal factors that produce like better outcomes, and then use that to bootstrap to trial and error, like actual knowledge. And knowledge here is defined as like theories or models that better predict the outcomes of your business actions to generate actual knowledge about like what produces good outcomes in software, right? I feel like the original, if you trace back to the original folk who copied Lean, which is Mary and Tom Papandik with a 2003 book called Lean Software Development, they just literally took Lean production practices that they saw in Dell manufacturing company and applied it to software development. And I think if Deming saw that, Deming would say, wow, you have zero theory of knowledge. Like you can't copy that from companies. You're supposed to bootstrap using actual trial and error, using the PDSA cycle, to figure out what actually works for you, to have actual knowledge, and then verify it by seeing changes in data. Anyway, so that's my little rant.
And I think there's some the differences too is software. Like, so software is more sort of, I hate to use the term ball of mud to describe it, but it's sort of true, where it's a kind of an evolving blob.
Yep.
This isn't a product.
Yep.
This is where they differ. right?
Yep.
Well, I think because you always see people saying, "Oh, let's think about the software assembly line," and I'm like, it's not, if you've seen an assembly line, that's not it's literally not how it works.
It's supposed to every piece is supposed to be the same on an assembly line in software. Yeah. You're always doing new features. Everything is different every time.
Yes. Oh, I this is one of my latest bugbears. But sorry to sort of not be so depressing, to not end this.
No, let's end on a really bad note.
No, no. I must give you positivity. I have lot. So compared to Sam, I am relatively new to these techniques. Compared to both you, Joe, and Matt, I don't know much about the data industry. But I will say that I've got very good results teaching this to business operators, right? That's cool. I say, like, don't care about your data team, right? You are just use Excel, doesn't matter. Amazon used Excel and generated the WBR and their XMR charts until they were a $1 billion company. And then of course they built tools that automated all of this. Mm-hmm. But they ran on Excel for a very long time, right? You go to your business operators and say, hey, here's a tool, right? And you need to go and figure, and then you teach them, like you show them, like, hey, use this tool to figure out root causes. And then try go investigate only the root causes. I think they are very receptive to, if you tell them you don't need to chase down every sort of delta. You just go chase it when the tool tells you to chase it, and then investigate that and save yourself the pain, the psychic pain of not knowing whether things are going up or down, right? And then from there you say, okay, and then you ask your boss, or you get your boss on board with this, and then you see whether you can go into a process change. I've taught this to a number of operators. One of them was a startup founder. He applied this to his sales organization. He immediately figured out, like, oh, the one thing that really worked is that, like, n number of days after the deal closes, you schedule a call, follow-up call, to sort of say, like, hey, who else would, like, do you know in other companies who might like this thing, this piece of software that we're selling? I've taught this to somebody who is a random individual contributor working in a hospital, right? A traditional hospital that doesn't really do SPC. She works on the growth side, the marketing side, right? She decided to track all the incoming data from calls to the various clinics, and then she decided to update the Google Maps because that was the one of the few things that she had access to and power over. The next week, exceptional variation across the board. And then, of course, then the next problem is that there is a conversion problem, right? Because, like, the calls come into a center call sort of department, and then it gets routed to the clinics, and then the conversion rate at the clinics sort of drop off, and she doesn't have the political power to go and try to change that. But she now has a tool that she trusts, that she understands, and a process of a way of looking at numbers that she knows can work. And now the job becomes like trying to get a political cover, which is a very different thing from, as an operator, not knowing how to look at data, not knowing how to use data, not knowing how, just running your business on vibes, right? On feelings, which is not good enough, right? So if you're in a data team, if I can do this, like as a random guy who's just learned these methods, right? Okay, I've been experimenting with it for 1.5 years, so it's not really just, but I'm not in these companies. I'm just randomly talking to these people and excitedly showing them, hey, here's what you can do. You can figure out what actually moves the needle for everything you care about, whatever you care about, right? I'm sure you as a data person inside a company can use these as well, and use this as a Trojan horse to then get trust. And then you can, like, bring in your sophisticated things. It could be even as something as dumb as, like, oh, what if I automatically generate like a XMR chart and email it to you every week, every Monday, right? So maybe.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, thanks for the great discussion, guys. I think we'll have to have him back on the show at some point again.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We need to reprise these topics at some point. Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. It's awesome. Well, thanks. And for people who want to learn more about what you guys are up to, XMRIT and Common Cog, how can they learn more?
I think the best thing is to hop on and sign up for the non-existent free email course on Xamarin.com. I'm supposed to finish it. I didn't finish it. Sorry, Sam. there will be a paid course as well. So that's how we justify the site. But eventually, over time, we want it to be just the single place that you can find and everything you need to know about this technique. The problem with a 90-year-old technique is that there are so many books and so many papers spread across the internet, and we've spent a huge amount of time. I've wasted a huge amount of time chasing down statistics papers, let's put it that way. And I would much rather have everything in one place. Yeah.
I would recommend Common Cog. Cedric's blog is still the best one to go to learn about his thinking. His data stories was a really great thing to read. And I can, if you're interested, that's the place to go.
Yeah, I've been reading your blog, Cedric, for years on Comic Blog. And I was like, this guy's definitely a different level of thinker or somebody. I don't know. He spoke to my soul when I started reading. I was like, okay, this guy's good. Someday I will get a chance to meet him. Here we are. So doesn't hurt that you're a Munger fanboy too. So he's one of my favorite people on the planet. So yeah, we're all getting requests to bring you guys back. So yeah, I think once Xamarin's up and running, and I think when we're got some more interesting content, we'll regroup and if you guys have podcasts, happy to be on your shows too. So
and then I can talk to you about Taguchi methods. Sorry, all these nerdy things.
We are very nerdy. I think it's one nerdier discussions we had recently, but there will be more.
We've had some pretty nerdy discussions.
Actually, every year this is definitely nerdy. Yeah. Speaking of which, next week we have Catherine Jarmul. She's gonna be talking about data privacy. She leads AI and privacy over at ThoughtWorks, and a couple weeks of real-time data stuff and a bunch of other stuff. So anyway, my dog's about to open my door now, so time to go. All right, she just did. Okay, all right, see y'all. Thanks, audience. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Take care.
Wait, Sam.